I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's the My First Gig podcast, whoa, sharing stories of first gigs and shows, comedians sharing their memories, the fun and entertaining, exciting and crazy, with Dwayne Dugan as your host. It's the My First Gig podcast, here we go.
Hello, how are you? What's the crack? Welcome back. It's me, it's Dwayne Dugan, it's your favourite world famous podcaster. Guys, thank you so much. We've really got to stop meeting like this. We could really make a habit of being here every single Wednesday on the My First Gig podcast. Hope you join me. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. First off, here we are, a week in. Absolutely delighted so far with the week one turnout for James Acaster. Fantastic guest, fantastic chat. Really hope you enjoyed it. And it's only going to get better, you know. Every single week we're going to have another new guest here telling their story. And you know what? Give it 6 months and you can go back and you can listen again. Because look, you're busy people. You have a lot going on. You're not going to remember what we spoke about. So you get to listen a second time. And then a third time. And then each time you tell your friends. And we all have good crack. But couldn't have asked for better listeners on week one. And couldn't have asked for a better guest. But here we are. Look, you know, as I told you. Coming from Dublin, Ireland, it's not so sunny. It's actually nighttime. It's quite raining. The wind is here. We had Storm Brendan over the weekend. Now, is that an Irish thing or is that a world thing? Like, I doubt if the winds, you know, kept going and hit New York, to be like, oh, Brendan's coming. That has to be an Irish thing, the whole Storm Brendan. Like, the names are dreadful. I think they go in, like, alphabetical order, so the next one will be, like, a letter C. I don't know, Storm Call. Could be the next one. I don't know. Who cares? Yeah, so it's less sunny, but as we're coming from Dublin, Ireland, maybe it's time to have my first Irish guest. I know. I shouldn't really be saying my first something guest. It's week two. Like, yeah, a guest I'm delighted to have. It's Ardlaw Hanlon, an absolute staple of the Irish comedy scene, a founding father of the Irish comedy scene, quite literally, as you'll hear throughout this episode. You know, this was such a great episode because it's not just his first gig. It's the first gig of what we now know is the Irish comedy scene, you know, over 30 years ago, and such a familiar face, you know, obviously Father Dougal Maguire in Father Ted, what was that, 1995, you know, we're going on 25 years on screen as one of the most recognisable characters of one of the best love shows and one of Ireland's greatest exports in Father Ted. It was brilliant to sit down with him. He was very kind. We messed up the first one with a little technical issue, and he decided to sit down and talk again, which I really, really appreciated. This was recorded last year while he was getting ready to kick off his tour. The showing off must go on. He dropped into Cherry Comedy to try out some new material. He'd been away from stand-up for some time, and here he was, you know, dipping his feet in, testing stuff out, getting ready, making sure that he was, you know, up to scratch before heading out on tour. And as someone who grew up watching Father Ted and, you know, loving the silliness and the ridiculousness of his character, I remember when I first moved to Cork City. I'm from a place called Cove outside of Cork, but when I first moved to the city, I was like, wow, I get to go to the comedy clubs now. And there was this great comedy club still there, City Limits. And the first weekend I went there, Ardlaw Hanlon was there. And I was like, oh my God, I still actually have the ticket from that night. It was very special. I got to play there years later and it was a lot of fun. But what was even more fun was, you know, not just sitting down and recording this chat with Ardlaw, but we recorded this, as I said, at Cherry Comedy in Whelans. And later at night he performed where I was hosting. And I got to introduce him on, you know, on my show, which, yeah, even seeing it now, I'm like, wow, that's, you know, no matter how many times I meet him or how many times I gig with him or whoever you gig with, or the feeling of how cool that is doesn't leave me. So it's great when he comes in to Whelans, to Cherry Comedy, to test out that stuff. So sit back, relax, why don't you run a little bubble, Matt, get a glass of wine, put down your favourite book and bring in your speakers and listen to our chat. Or just on your commute to work or sitting in the office, whatever you prefer. Up to you. Whichever it is, sit back and listen to My First Gig with Ardlaw O'Hanlon.
In my case, there's loads of things to test out. Test out everything. Like, am I happy with my voice, with the timbre and the tone? There's a lot of brand new stuff that I'm working away on, and I'll work away on it right up to the last minute. I just keep writing and writing and writing, and then do 2 weeks of really intensive warm-ups, putting the whole show together, where you start weeding out the stuff that isn't working quite as well. These kind of nights in Whelan's on a Monday night are really useful for just putting little chunks together. It's like in football or rugby, putting little combinations together. Like, will those two things go well together? You know, is that a nice transition from that bit to that bit? There's loads of things to experiment with every time. I mean, it's a little bit frustrating because I don't do that much. You know, I only pop into these clubs once every week or once every 2 or 3 weeks sometimes. So you don't have that continuity where you can kind of capitalize on what you do one night the next night.
Sure, yes. And I guess it's probably even still different going out and saying doing 25, 30 minutes compared to the energy of what you're doing for an hour.
Yeah.
So even if you do a bit here tonight, if that's placed, say, 35 minutes in, it could be completely different, I'd say.
Yeah, it's really frustrating that as well, like just doing 20 minutes because it's gone in the blink of an eye. When you're used to doing an hour and 15, like doing 20 is just, it's you know, you get a certain amount out of it, but, you're always left a little bit frustrated.
And say now that week that you do that kind of preview run before you kick off officially, will you put a stamp on it then, or will you allow it to develop as the tour goes on?
Oh yeah, I'll still hopefully in theory allow it to develop as it goes on. But I mean, it's great to have a structure in place, and it's just great to be really confident about stuff.
Sure.
Like, I mean, there are some comedians who come up with a new show every year, and fair play to them. I've never been one of those people. Like, partly to do with, I've always had other irons in the fire, but also partly because I don't work at that rate, I kind of daydream an awful lot, So, for me, these things are gestating away slowly for years. You're working on a little bit of material that you might have been working on 5 years ago, but you never tried it out. So I'm still developing stuff that I've had for 20 years.
Well, no, I think that's fair because, obviously I wouldn't, go against anybody's work rate or if, putting out a show every year. I spoke to people who took the same show to, say, the Edinburgh Fringe 2 years in a row or even 3 years in a row, and they say, they could have put out three separate shows,
yeah.
But at the end of it, what they had finished in their hand was so much better than it would have been had they just done the year and dropped it.
Yeah.
So I think it needs that time because it needs to last.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you drop it in a year and you revisit it, it could be very outdated. But if it sticks with you over 3 years, it might stick with you 10 years later
I think that's absolutely right. And I also think stand-up is it evolves. Which I think is the same point you're kind of making in a way. Like I'm very reluctant to discard stuff completely. I mean, you got to change your show every time you go out and tour. But, I think you got to build on what you've already built. Good stand-up is like good wine or something. It benefits from sort of storage in your head or whatever. But yeah.
Before I go back and get into your first gig and ask you what your first memory of comedy would be, what comes to mind for you?
My first ever memory of comedy, of laughing, or of seeing people producing comedy was Laurel and Hardy. Saturday morning, I think, during the summer holidays probably. I would have been about 6 or 7, myself and my older brother. We loved Laurel and Hardy, so we used to get up early Saturday mornings. They'd show about 7 episodes in a row. I think it was all that RTE had in those days. It was Laurel and Hardy repeats, a little bit of Harold Lloyd, some of those silent movies, Buster Keaton and stuff like that. And to this day, I still love Laurel and Hardy. I remember I bought the box set DVDs a few years ago when my kids were very small, and I got them into it as well, and they all loved it. And I was really pleasantly surprised that it stood up quite well. It's basically the blueprint for double acts, blueprint for slapstick comedy. I personally like Stan Laurel. I think he influenced me sometimes. I'm a little bit sheepish about saying that. Sometimes the influence is really obvious, I think, sometimes, particularly in Father Ted and, me playing Father Dougal and Father Ted. It's kind of like you're kind of doing a version of Stan Laurel, but it's unavoidable. They were that good. They loomed large in your imagination.
If I had to go further and ask what your first memory of live comedy, Do you have any first memory of live comedy? Now, this might be a bit different because obviously,
yeah,
we'll get into that.
I mean, there was really no live comedy in Ireland when I started out. So I started out in the International Bar, in the Comedy Cellar, 1988, probably, first ever gig. Myself and Barry Murphy, Kevin Gildee, and Dermot Carmody. We're part of a group called Mr. Trellis Sketch Group, and then Carl McDermott was there as well in that very first gig. So there was five of us. And I don't honestly think I had ever seen a live show before I did it myself. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm struggling. I'm really struggling to think. I mean, we would have seen old VHS copies of American comedy legends, people like Robin Williams. You know, really fuzzy copies. You could hardly see them. Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, Stephen Wright, and Steve Martin doing his Wild and Crazy Guy. So they were about the only five comedy videos in the video store in my town in Carrickmacross.
So they were in the video store?
Yes.
So I guess somebody's shipping them over. I guess if they're in Carrickmacross, they're probably in Dublin and other places. But why do you think, even though there was an audience to consume that sort of entertainment, that there didn't seem to be it produced here?
Yeah, there didn't seem to be an equivalent. Later on, you realise that there were kind of, you know, there were people like Niall Tobin in operation, who was actually really funny. Like, he did accents and he did kind of stories. He wore a white dinner jacket and a dicky bow, and he sort of did the after dinner circuit, or what passed for an after dinner circuit in Ireland in those days. And then you had like really traditional comedians like Hal Roach and other people who just told jokes like about Murphy and O'Brien, and, you know, kind of really old-fashioned jokes about mother-in-laws and stuff like that. You know, they all had great timing and, you know, good performing skills and everything else. But that would never have appealed to me, I don't think. Brendan Grace was on record. There was LPs of Brendan Grace, and I remember as a kid thinking they were really funny. We had one of them, Bottler, doing some really funny routines, some really funny sketches. But it was really the American comedians that I looked to, or certainly got the first wave of inspiration was from them, watching them going, wow, that is so exciting and so dynamic and so daring and everything, you know. And I suppose the one that leapt out at me as a starting point was Stephen Wright, who did one-liners, surreal one-liners. I can't even remember any of them now, but I probably watched that particular tape about 100 times.
Well, I guess that kind of medium doesn't really exist here. It's going to seem like, you know, sort of exotic or something, you know, especially in those days, almost out of this world from an Irish perspective. What led then? So you were in college with Barry Murphy and Kevin Kildee.
Yeah.
And was there something in college? Did you start doing things in college that kind of influenced the decision to maybe seek out a performance? Or I'm trying to think, would the stand-ups going on before bands, do you know if this was around that era? Or was that, did that follow this?
There was a tiny bit of it, yeah. Yeah, there was a tiny, tiny bit of it. I remember seeing Paul Tyler before I knew him, opening for a band called the Baby Snakes, who were a pretty cool indie band in Dublin around the time of the big indie explosion in Dublin, late 80s. But really, I think just when I was in college, like in DCU, or what was then NIHE, it was called, like we just thought we would do something. We thought from early enough on that we would try comedy at some stage, that we would try and be like those guys that we saw on the tapes when we were a bit younger. And also by then, stand-up started appearing on British TV. People like Sean Hughes, Irish guys like Sean Hughes, Michael Redmond, Ian McPherson, Owen O'Neill. Suddenly you'd see these guys who weren't that different to us, they dressed the same as us, and they had the same sort of concerns, and they were kind of funny, and they were kind of loose, and they were kind of cool. And you'd occasionally see them popping up on British TV, you know, on a Friday night or a Saturday night. There was comedy shows on that was trying to, you know, ride on that wave of new comedy that was happening at the time. So, you know, it was beginning to become a possibility. So we kind of looked at each other and we said, well, you know, let's give this a go. We'd already sort of, our first little forays into comedy was Debating Society in DCU.
And I guess when you're watching these things, are you aware that it's British TV? Like, obviously, where it's British TV, but that's like filmed and stuff in Britain?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you like, so as far as I remember, the name of the show that was on BBC was Friday Night Live, and then that later became Saturday Night Live. And you would see comedians like Lee Evans on it, Jack D, Joe Brand, and a few others, you know. And like, that was the first sort of realization that it wasn't impossible. It wasn't an impossible dream. When you put together your first 3 or 4 minutes, you know, it's not that different. It's not that much worse than what the people on television were doing. You know, in some cases, in the cockiness of youth, you thought it was actually a little bit better.
London's obviously a lot closer than, you know, the guys that you saw on those VHS tapes, but it's still not here. So It's still like a kind of, it's not impossible, but it's still pretty difficult. Basically, it's not here. When I started, when anybody I talked to started, literally everybody who's on the scene now, when they started, they went to one of the clubs and found out how to start. But without that, what gave you the guys the idea to go, right?
Well, there was a couple of things. I mean, first of all, this is literally true. There was nothing else to do. That's a fact. You know, the economy was like really shit, like much worse than it's ever been in the recent recessions or anything. It was like really bad. So there was no career opportunities or anything like that. So it was very normal for people leaving college to become poets or become musicians mainly, I suppose. Or just become layabouts. You know, that was your options: poetry, music, or layabouts. And we chose comedy. You know, we just decided like there's nobody doing this. It's becoming popular on television. We've seen the American VHSs. We've seen the stuff on English television. You know, let's just try and do it. And I know Barry had been to London one summer and he'd gone to the Comedy Store. And he kind of pushed it, I think, more than any of the rest of us when he came back. He said, look, let's just get a little room in a pub and let's just set up something. And, we'll do some sketches and we'll do little bits of stand-up and should we just see? And so there was no real, there was no real idea that there would be a career at the end of it or anything. But like we just said, we'd give it a go to pass the time as much as anything else. And it was kind of like a mutual support, you know, kind of the International became sort of a drop-in center for would-be comedians.
I'm looking at my questions here, but it's interesting. I have to almost like deviate from them because it's not traditionally a first gig. It's a first gig is not only your first gig, but it's the first gig that you're running, but it's also the first gig of the Irish comedy scene. It's like it's quite a kind of a big bang moment almost.
Yeah. I mean, maybe in hindsight it is. Other people might dispute that there were other little gigs somewhere else, but yeah, certainly at the time, it didn't feel like a big bang moment. Or it like there was probably 20 people in the audience. There were probably all people we knew. And it was probably very, very ropey. I mean, I do remember it very distinctly, though. Like, I remember everything about it. I remember what I was wearing. I remember the nerves. I remember all of that. For the record, I was wearing a very cheap secondhand suit, kind of a zoot suit that I got in George Street Arcade in Dublin.
A suit for your first show?
Yeah, we used to wear suits in those days, like they're really cool mod type suits. But I made it less cool because I had a cold and I wore a jumper under the suit. A really horrible jumper in the color of Eason's wrapping paper. Do you know kind of purple and green and wasn't great. But I remember the gig going really well. Like I was very nervous. I was my leg was shaking. I was sweating a lot and I was stammering a bit, but I settled down pretty quickly. And, you know, to my amazement, you know, a lot of people, the people who were there laughed and to people who haven't done comedy, it's very hard to convey the excitement of that. You know, that first big roar of laughter that you get for something that you produced that came out of your head.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Let's talk about producing that. So, you know, you've got all these other responsibilities, I'm guessing, between the four of you on the day or on the night or even in the lead up to it. But at what point do you start working on material? Do you do it just yourself or is it the three of you going up?
Well, we were working on sketches mostly at the time, I suppose. We all had our own little bit of stand-up going on sort of parallel. But the main focus of those nights in the International Bar, those first few nights, were sketches. And we only had one or two sketches, but you know, there were they got laughs as well. You know, they were okay, you know, but I think that first night I did about 10 minutes of stand up. And there was at least one joke there that I was still doing like 5 years later, you know. So I don't know.
They couldn't have been terrible.
Yeah, it wasn't terrible. And I mean, and the other thing that was really interesting was that, you know, you don't set out to create a style or a persona. I think that happens naturally. I think that's for most comedians. You know, you're not really aware of it. I certainly wasn't aware of it. And I think that was a good thing. So I just let sort of a naive element just come through, you know, because we were naive in some ways. And you know, you just let that come to the fore. You just let some part of you, some aspect of your own personality, you just let that be the dominant thing. And in my case, I thought that naivety was quite good. Like, it worked for me. I didn't plan it. It just, but I pretend it sort of to be really, I think it's a defensive thing when you start out. You kind of hide behind, oh, I'm really stupid here. So I'll just, I'll be really uptight and my shoulders will be really bunched. And I'll pretend I don't know what's going on in the world. So you do these jokes that are they're actually little bombs in a way, you know, like they're kind of incendiary, but they're cloaked in innocence. And that was just the way my style developed.
So 10 minutes and that joke you were doing for 5 years, does it stay in your memory now? Would you remember what it could be?
It was something about, it was an observational along the lines of, do you know the way when you're talking to somebody and they're talking to you and your faces are very close to each other and they're spitting all over your face. And it was along those lines. It was an observation anyway about trying to pretend that the person isn't spitting in your face and just talking to them as if nothing is happening. And I can't really remember it now, but it stood me in good stead for years. I mean, you know, obviously if you were to look back at the 10 minutes I did that night, you know, and what I know now, I would have quit like the night, you know, the next day, like, you know, you really, I thought that was funny, you know, but, you live and learn, you know, but I mean, there was enough there, certainly in that first night and certainly in that first 6 months to realize that, you know, like despite my own problems in terms of like, I was kind of shy. I wasn't what you might call a natural performer. I wasn't the best writer in the world in terms of like, you know, generating loads of material. But, you know, I definitely knew that I wasn't a complete fool to be doing it, or I wasn't completely wasting my time, because you saw other people who were clearly wasting their time who, you know, used to drop in and do open spots and things, and you thought, you know, well, at least I'm not them.
I want to stick on that day. Do you spend the day with the guys? Do you spend the day on your own in preparation?
Yeah, we used to spend a lot of time together. I mean, we spent nearly all day, every day with each other, you know, and not necessarily writing. Like, we weren't the most productive people in the world. I mean, I think this is a really crucial point as well. I mean, because there was no career path and there were no clubs to play and there was no obvious route to success, like, we definitely had a philosophy, if not a manifesto, like, that comedy was about, it was about enjoying yourself. It was about living a slightly bohemian existence. you know, we were very opposed to the whole idea of making money, like, you know, because there was obviously no chance of making any money. But so therefore, our philosophy was that people who make money are evil. You know, it was like that kind of undergraduate type of philosophy, you know, that we had. You know, so it was all about like just passing the time. And, you know, so most of our day wasn't spent writing. It was spent arguing and playing football. We used to just play football all day long. Argue, sit. We used to, our office was upstairs in Burger King in a booth where we'd sit over like one cup of coffee for the whole day, literally the whole day. And we just like, just talk about everything. And they were in some ways the best days of my life, you know, those formative years where you kind of, you know, you just have a great laugh with your mates, you know. And so we certainly weren't taking it very seriously for the first 3 years.
Like, obviously, there's so many more hurdles in the fact that there was no proven path. There was no, as you said, the idea of making money or a career or anything out of it. But I guess on the pro side, that freedom, there's no risk.
Yeah.
You know, if there's no goal, there's no risk, I guess. And
that is so true. That is so true. And, you know, it isn't until much later, like when you go to London and you commit, that suddenly, you know, you start getting a bit nervous and you start worrying about what people think and all those things as you get more and more kind of attention or whatever, more and more work, you know, more notice, and suddenly you're being paid a bit better. You feel a bit more responsibility, you know? So yeah, that does come later, and it doesn't take the fun out of it or anything. It's still, you know, it's always great to be able to do it. But nothing really compares to those first few times, I don't think.
And on that first time in particular, do you remember kind of the format of the night? Did you just go back one or the other? Did somebody kind of take the hosting duties? Or
yeah, Barry sort of very quickly became the regular MC for the international. And then, you know, within a few months, we had other people coming along as well. We had another sketch group who called themselves Comic Soufflé. And then, you know, I'll get the timing all wrong, but certainly within 2 or 3 years, you had, you know, stand-ups like Alex Lyons, who came from an advertising background. Jerry Kennedy came from an advertising background. The Quack Squad, who were Joe Rooney and Paul Tylock, who came in with some really cool rock and roll type sketches. And, you know, then the floodgates started to open and more people joined in, and then other clubs started opening up and stuff. And then we had like amazing visitors. Like I remember Dylan Moran's first open spot, which would have been about 2 years after we started. And he came in and he was brilliant. Same night Eddie Izzard was on. Eddie Izzard was in town. He was just breaking big at that time. He wasn't like the big international star that he is today, but he was, you know, he was getting pretty well known. And he was doing some gigs in Dublin and he wanted to do a little bit of a warm-up just to test the waters. And he came into the International Bar, did half an hour, probably the best half an hour I've ever seen in there, doing all this stuff about dinosaurs and everything. And that was the same night Dylan did his first open spot. So like that was a legendary night, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there were great nights. And we all used to like go to Blazes afterwards, which was this late night drinking den. Like Dublin was a desert in those days for cool places to go to after gigs. But that was one that we all went to. So all the low life of Dublin were there. All the comedians and musos and drifters and wasters. It was brilliant. Like it was really exciting. And then we go back to my place and play poker until 6 in the morning. So it was great. Great life.
I mentioned that kind of, you know, either a freedom or a lack of risk or something, but did you feel you're preparing for your first gig, or were you nervous for the first time? Because you're saying you're going up there doing sketches and 10 minutes of material as well, you know, so it's a lot to juggle in one night. Yeah, when I guess you haven't performed on the stage like that before.
Yeah, no, I was terrified, yeah. I was really, really, really nervous, yeah. I mean, and even for the first 5 or 10 years, like I was pretty nervous before most gigs. But certainly that first night, like it was like you know, free diving from a plane or something, like just skydiving, just jumping out of a plane with no parachute. That's what it's like, you know. You almost kind of go blank for a split second, you know, where your senses are kind of shut down as a kind of a defense mechanism, so you can't see, you can't hear anything for a few seconds. Feels like hours, but it's probably only a few seconds. And then you kind of get a grip and you sort of, you know, get in control. And then very quickly, like it's probably only 30 seconds, you're relaxed and you're breathing normally. And you know, you're into it. It's cool.
And was there people on before you that night?
Yeah, I mean, there was probably Kevin or Barry or someone. I don't know where I went on.
Do you remember if that helped you or not? Like, I seeing other people going on, or are you just kind of sitting there focusing on yourself and waiting for your turn, I guess?
Yeah, I was pretty, you know, in my own bubble, I suppose, for most of the evening and just waiting my turn. I mean, I probably had rehearsed it about 100 times, you know, over the previous 3 or 4 days or week or whatever, you know, so I kind of, you know, knew it word for word.
Even in the mirror, there wasn't that 20 people in the mirror looking at you. Any memories from that first night of yourself being on stage? Were you happy with it?
Yeah, I mean, I was really happy with it. I thought it went well, you know. Got great feedback, you know, and it just made you want to get up again. And we didn't have another gig for about a month afterwards, but you couldn't wait to get home. I remember, you know, because you walked everywhere as well. You know, there was no Lewis, there was no bus, there was no taxi fare. So, you know, I remember walking home like walking on air. You know that expression. That's exactly what it feels like. You're walking on air.
So immediately you wanted to go, keep going, and try it again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Couldn't wait to get up the next morning. You know, you just feel so good, so powerful. Like coming from a position of like feeling really shit most of the time and really powerless and badly nourished. And, you know, like I can't describe to you what it's like when you left college in those days, living in dingy beds, it's freezing cold all the time, you know, eating like really badly and you know, not really having a steak. Some of your friends from school, you know, with proper jobs. You see them on the street sometime, you feel like hiding, you know. You know, your self-esteem wouldn't be great, but like when you do something like that and it gets a reaction like it did, you feel brilliant. You know, it feels great. It was one of the best moments, you know. I experienced it again about 5 years later when I did my first ever Comedy Store gig in London. That was the nearest thing I ever got to it. It was like, because London was obviously a big deal going to London. And then the Comedy Store was the height of my ambition in those days. I didn't even know there was I thought that was the ceiling. I remember going to play the Comedy Store and it going really well. And I mean, you know, I was thinking, so now my last 3 or 4 years have not been wasted in Dublin, you know, playing in front of 20, 30 people, because I had a good set by the time I got to London. And I just remember that night walking, I think I lived about 10 miles from the Comedy Store, but, you know, just the best feeling.
That same walking on air feeling.
Same walking on air feeling. But I don't think it's ever really been, I've never really got that again. Doing anything.
Well, I guess, yeah, it's probably hard to replicate how exciting that was the first time.
Yeah.
If I could ask, because of the unique nature of the Comedy Cellar being, you know, your first gig and being one of its founders, it's still there. It's passed through so many hands, yet it's still there. What do you feel when you look at it now and its legacy? Do you feel attachment to it still? Do you feel...
I don't really feel attachment to it, but I do feel a certain pride.
Yeah.
A certain, like, fatherly pride. I mean, I'm very happy that we established it. We made it our own for a while, and I'm very happy with the way it evolved. You know, the fact that nobody ever really owned it or anything, that you just passed on the torch. You know, I'm quite happy that is the cool hippie way it was. You know, it was originally the way it was originally planned. You know, that it would be this cool place. Like I used to, you know, the comparison of a drop-in center, you know, for comedians. You know, it's a place where, you know, it was there to foster comedy, it was there to support comedians. You know, when we were there, all the comedians would come, if they weren't on the bill, they'd come and watch. I remember Andrew Maxwell, like, as a schoolboy bunking off on school nights, coming in, sitting in the front row. He watched it for 2 or 3 years before he got up and did his first open spot, you know. So all that kind of stuff, like, I remember very fondly. But I don't feel any ownership or anything like that towards it, you know.
If you could go back to that night, 1988, upstairs in the International Comedy Cellar, if you could pull yourself aside right before you have to go on and give yourself some advice, other than don't wear the jumper, maybe.
Yeah, definitely don't wear the jumper. What I would say to myself is that, you know, while it's good to be motivated and it's good to have a little frisson of tension and everything else, I wasted far too much of my energy panicking. There is nothing to fear. You know, that's like, that goes for that night. It also goes for a lot of the nights after that. You know, 99% of the time it went well. It was, there was never anything to worry about. There was, you know, I stressed unnecessarily about gigs. It should be the most joyful thing in the world.
Well, if I could counter you, I see people who do get stressed, and I see people who, but then every time I gig with them, I wish it went as well for me as it is for them in that way. And I'm like, and then I'm like, why aren't I panicking? And I think, do you think maybe without the panic, the panic's almost, it drives you, and it stops you from getting complacent.
It does, yeah. It's like, I think it's a little bit of what it is. I think is, it's a little bit of perfectionism, which is not necessarily the person I want to be, but I think it is sort of like, in terms of my approach to comedy, it is the way I have been, is trying to be as, like, try to make this as good as possible. Try to be the best comedian I can be. Not about being better than anyone else. It's been the best comic you can be. Just nailing everything, being word perfect. You know, so it's a type of control freakery in a way. Thankfully, I don't bring that into other aspects of my life. But certainly in the approach to work, I just thought, like, you know, this is the first thing I found in my life that I can do well. You know, and, you know, I want to do it really well.
Yeah, great chatting. Thank you for chatting for your first gig.
Thank you.
There we go. That's it, guys. That is Ard Lohanan. That was his first gig. Thank you so much for tuning in. Now, I did look at the stats and the analytics for the episode last week, and the last 2.5 minutes, which was primarily this bit, once James had said goodbye and once I came back in, this is when people started to tune out. So if you've left, you know, there's not much I can do about it now. I have a lot to offer. I wish you would have stayed. A couple of nice reviews and a couple of nice messages saying, yeah, a lot of hosts talk too much. Dwayne thankfully just let James speak. And then the second I speak, you all ran out the door. So if you're listening here, maybe I'll maybe dial back my attitude and be friendly. Hey guys, we're all friends. It's me, world famous podcaster Dwayne Dugan, and you, my new friend. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. But honestly, no, guys, thank you so much again for tuning in. This is, you know, this podcast is useless if you don't listen. Please, please, please keep tuning in. Most importantly, please spread the word. If you enjoyed today's episode, chuck it up on your Instagram story. Chuck it up on Twitter. Chuck it up on, I don't know, my friend downloaded TikTok the other day and he said, yeah, it's all kids, but you got to be doing it. You got to be throwing up stuff on TikTok. TikTok is officially where I've become too old for the new apps. I'm not an old person. I'm 31 years old, right? But I downloaded TikTok and I goes, oh, well, look, everyone's going to do it. I downloaded it primarily because I wanted to get my username, because I don't have my, just at Dwayne. That's all I wanted, was at Dwayne. I have that nowhere because I missed out everywhere. I was 21 when I signed up for Twitter, so I signed up for Sir Dwayne because I thought that was cool. What an idiot. And then some wedding photographer who barely uses it took Dwayne, and I hate him. I hate him with a passion. Send him mean tweets. So I signed up just to get my username. That was already gone. And then I tried to understand it. I don't have a clue what's going on. TikTok's officially my way of bowing out. So there is no My First Gig TikTok, but there is an Instagram, there is a Facebook, and there is a Twitter at My First Gig Pod, or you can get them all by going to myfirstgigpod.com. Subscribe, leave a review, do all the usual things, but most importantly, tell your friends and come back next week. Appreciate you tuning in. Spread the word. See you next week. Next week's guest announced on social media ahead of time. If you subscribe, you get the episode before anybody else. And who wouldn't want this about an hour and a half early? I know I wouldn't. Guys, see you next Wednesday. Thank you.
It's the My First Gig Podcast.